On critical theory, cultural studies, and postmodern theory. I'm your host again, Michael Reckenwald. And today we're going to resume our discussion of the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory. And in particular, we're taking up a discussion of Herbert Marcuse, probably one of the most important Frankfurt School theorists and also a very important figure in the American left, as we shall see. Marcuse lived from 1898 to 1979. He was an immigrant from Germany, along with other Frankfurt School members. He fled Nazi Germany in 1933. He first set up shop at Columbia University, then at UC Berkeley, and then finally at Brandeis. Marcuse is regarded as one of the most important symbols of the New Left, according to the New York Times. The most important literary symbol, they put it in. By that, they mean one of the most important writers for the New Left. And we'll talk about what the New Left is or was, as opposed to the Old Left. Marcuse held positions in the U.S. State Department under the guise of understanding and opposing fascism. So here's an avowed socialist working in the heart of the administration in the State Department. And using the cover of opposing Nazism is actually developing socialist theories right within the heart of the government. So that's pretty curious. Speaking of the establishment, he received financial support from the American Council of Learned Societies, the Lewis Rabinowitz Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, and the Social Science Research Council. So he was well endowed by pretty establishment organizations. Of all the Frankfurt School theorists that we'll treat, and these are the main ones, Marcuse and Adorno and Horkheimer, Marcuse was perhaps the most practical. That is, that he never abandoned an attempt to develop a theory of social change that could be implemented in the real world in real time. So unlike Adorno, who went into semi-political retirement and effectively was an armchair analyst, Marcuse would stay engaged politically. He wasn't so much marching in the streets as writing the treatises that would be read by the left, especially students, in the 60s. His theory of social change would develop Marxism, infuse it with psychology, sociology, philosophy, and other fields in order to arrive at the modern, a theory for the modern industrial age. And so we're going to see a change in nomenclature here. This is not your standard Marxism, which is, you know, has the simple categories of working class versus capitalist class. We're going to see a whole new set of characters or characterizations, I should say, of the enemy, and also of the political agent that Marcuse would look for social change. The problems, as Marcuse saw them, included especially the integration of the proletariat into capitalist society. And by this we mean, again, the working class is appearing to be indistinct and indistinguishable from other elements of the social order. They're integrated in the sense that they have achieved a standard of living which does not set them aside as immiserated and therefore likely to burst into rebellion. They have been assimilated in terms of not only production but consumption. And that's a big problem for Marxism. That's, in fact, a disaster for Marxism. And then there's the stabilization of capitalism, which Marcuse saw as also negative, of course, for Marxism. The stabilization of the capitalist system is a problem because it speaks to the quiescence, potentially, of the working class and their lack of impetus to actually do anything to change the system, which seems to be doing pretty well by them. And especially in comparison with the Soviet Union, which they knew was not doing so well. Rather than seeing these features of stabilization and integration into the social body, as welcome the facts of capitalism, Marcuse viewed them in terms of the failure to develop socialism. So, once again, these are just disasters for socialism. Other problems that he noted was the bureaucratization of socialism in the Soviet bloc. And here, he's drawing on the theories of Max Weber, Max Weber, who was a German sociologist, a bit of a critic of Marx, but no less critical. He criticized society for its increasing bureaucratization or rationalization of everything, kind of what he called the iron cage of rationality, in which the new oppression is not so much class oppression, but rather rationality itself, this kind of organizational rationality, which is akin to the instrumental rationality that we mentioned and discussed in the previous class with Adorno and Horkheimer. But it's not quite the same. This is the kind of rationality that is about what Marcuse would call the administered life, the bureaucratization of life vis-a-vis the administration of it, vis-a-vis government and other agencies. Rather than focusing on the results of communism during this period, he turned his critique mostly on Western society. In the book that we're about to look to, One Dimensional Man, he does mention the Soviet bloc, but very, very slightly. So again, Marcuse saw the integration of the proletariat as dreadful, and as a dreadful indication or feature of industrial capitalism or technological society. The working class was given up as the revolutionary agent for overcoming capitalism. And this is significant because this is what is meant by the new left. This is the first step. You first have to give up the working class as the agent for revolution. And then, in place of the working class, which was proving not to be the vaunted agent of history that Marx made it out to be, Marcuse hoped to cobble together various identity groups and interest groups and coalesce them in a struggle to overthrow the system, which is no longer just simply described as capitalism, rather, but as advanced industrial society, technological society, advanced industrial civilization, and the administered society. It's a little hard to see what he's talking about from our standpoint, but this idea that there was a new administration layer of society that would become oppressive, advanced industrial society, which was somehow oppressive, or advanced industrial civilization or technological society seen as oppressive. Okay. So, Marcuse's main book is One Dimensional Man. I should say it's his most important book. It's not his main book, but this is his magnum opus. And in this book, he did say that both capitalist and communist societies were totalitarian. Now, how he gets to that with reference to capitalist society in 1964 in the United States is quite hard to understand, but he does manage to do so. As I said, he directed his critique at the West and the U.S. in particular. He argued that the technological rationality of administered life in advanced industrial society infiltrates existence and effectively mass produces and controls everything. In meeting needs and providing affluence for some, the technological society eradicates individuality and individual rationality. What is being said here is that the system begins to absorb everyone into it in a kind of satisfaction. And satisfaction is the problem because there's no longer opposition. So in providing affluence even, the system actually eradicates the self or the individual and individual rationality. And what he means here is oppositional rationality, as we'll see. A rationality that would be opposed to the existing system, which he sees as diminishing in possibility. The system manages this by determining needs. It makes up the needs and then satisfies them So then, therefore, it makes for a willing conformity with its own demands. So the system produces needs, then meets them, and therefore creates a conformity of its subjects by virtue of filling these needs, which it has already dubbed as the ones to meet. The administered society is totalizing, says Marcuse. That is, it's complete. There's no outside of it. Nothing, not even criticism of it, escapes its reach. So this is curious coming from someone who was supported by such institutions as the Rockefeller Foundation and worked in the State Department, and yet is saying that the administered society is totalizing and not even criticism escapes its reach. Just curious whether this applied to him. In a prospectus to the book One Dimensional Man, Marcuse writes, "The chief characteristic of this new mode of thought, this new rationality and behavior, is the repression of all values, aspirations, and ideas which cannot be defined in the terms of the operations and attitudes validated by the prevailing norms of rationality." So, whatever doesn't accord with the rationality, the dominant rationality here, is effectively outmoded or completely repressed. It can't even be expressed. The consequence is the weakening, even the disappearance, of all genuinely radical critique, the integration of all opposition into the established system. So not only was the working class absorbed into the system, so was all radical critique. No, there's no Archimedean standpoint here now for opposing the system. Everything is subsumed by it, and likewise, there's nowhere to stand but in it. And this is interesting because in Chapter 1, Marcuse will condemn free enterprise straight off the top. Freedom of enterprise was from the beginning not altogether a blessing. As the liberty to work or to starve, it spelled toil, insecurity, and fear for the vast majority of the population. So, they see, this is typical for the view of free enterprise from the left, in that it's deemed to be sort of a ruse that is extended and seems to be apply equally, but really is only a boon to those who have capital. And for everyone else, it's a miserable lottery of life. So he's arguing that once the individual is no longer compelled to improve himself on the market as a free economic subject, the disappearance of this kind of freedom would be one of the greatest achievements of civilization. So the elimination of the free market, he says, would be one of the greatest achievements of civilization. So there is no sense of the connection of freedom to the free market. There's no understanding of that type. In fact, Marxism, its notion of freedom is freedom from necessity. So that was the aim, to liberate humanity, supposedly the aim, into a state of freedom from necessity. That is, freedom from necessities imposed on us by nature and by life in the social life, social order. So freedom is not conceived of as the freedom to do as you will, but it's rather the freedom from necessity, and that's exactly what he's referring to here. If this could be achieved, then that would be the greatest, and it could only be achieved, by the way, through the elimination of the free market. This would be one of the greatest achievements of civilization. Marcuse aimed to level against existing social norms, practices, and ways of thought what he called negative thinking, which is not the same as the opposite of positive thinking, but rather this is the negation, critical thought that seeks to negate the dominant modes of thought and seeks alternative modes of thought and behavior from which it creates a standpoint of critique. Quote, "Mere existence would be negated in favor of realizing higher potentialities, while norms discovered by reason would be used to criticize and overcome lower forms of thought and social organization." And this is from the introduction by Douglas Kellner, who introduced one of the latest editions of this book, if not the latest. And what he's saying here is that there is the possibility of discovering better ways of being. But this is only after this critical reason engages in the negation of that which is standing as an impediment to that. And again, critical thinking depends on the dialectical method, and this is the dialectical method of negation, where you have either a thesis and its negation by the antithesis, or you have the negation of the negation. So, say freedom is the object and it's negated by repression, the negation of the negation would be liberation from repression. This dialectical thinking as opposed to one-dimensional thinking, which is very, very hard to really grasp what he means by one-dimensional thinking. But what he's saying here is very akin to what Adorno and Horkheimer have said about instrumental reasoning, or reasoning as a mere means to end. Like, how do you, you know, how do I arrange my schedule today, or how do I make some money, or how do I, whatever. These are these instrumental reason, which is demoted as, what's elevated is critical reason again. Critical reason is this reason that's always criticizing and trying to oppose the existing system, which is the elevated form of thought. But at this time, Marcuse saw the current state of affairs as barring social change. So there was very little chance for opposition, he thought. That the opposition was frozen in a unity of opposites, or the contradictions between the current prevailing way of thinking, the status quo, and the oppositional way of thinking were frozen. So the dialectic, in effect, is in a freeze mode. There's no interplay between the forces because they're frozen in place. Now I'm going to move to another piece which I think is more important for our purposes. And this is an essay entitled Repressive Tolerance, which was published in 1965 in a slim volume called Critique of Pure Reason, with two other authors, and Marcuse was the third of the three, certainly the highlighter, the cleanup position. And unfortunately, this essay has been extremely influential on the left, and it goes a long way in explaining the left's belief about expression and tolerance, and how they can justify intolerance to views that they don't accept. Here we have the rationale. It's all in this book. And it was very, very influential. In it, he argues for the intolerance that leftists currently demonstrate against the expression which they disapprove. That is all but leftist expression. Marcuse begins with his conclusion. The conclusion reached in this essay, he writes, is that the realization of the objective of tolerance would call for intolerance towards prevailing policies, attitudes, opinions, and the extension of tolerance to policies, attitudes, and opinions which are outlawed or suppressed. So, at the time, 1965, he saw this repression as towards what you would call policies, attitudes, and opinions that were oppositional to the status quo. I wonder if this would apply symmetrically if he were alive to the current conditions for those who are not on the left. We'll see. This is intended as being partial to the expression of the left in 1965. Which must strike us ironic in 2020. That is to say, this partiality would seem to apply to the right now, because theirs is the opinion that is suppressed, and theirs are the policies that are not allowed to be implemented, or theirs are the very opinions which are not allowed to be voiced. It is the left that now is intolerant to all but their prevailing attitudes, policies, and opinions. And their policies, attitudes, and opinions are the prevailing attitudes, policies, and opinions. As we see with cancel culture, and this is just a brief divergence here, against Trump supporters or even non-Black Lives Matter committed people, the attitudes, policies, and opinions of others are not tolerated. How did we get here? Well, the reasoning in Mark Hoos's essay should make all this very clear. Mark Hoos argues that tolerance for expression was born in opposition to existing power. So, tolerance only came and was only granted for those who were out of power. The very notion of freedom of speech, he suggests, was always about granting expression to those who had no power, who were out on the outside of the system or disempowered relative to the leadership. He likewise argues that real tolerance should not be impartial at all, but rather that it should favor oppositional expression. And here we begin to go down the rabbit hole. How does he reach this conclusion? This conclusion that it should not be impartial. Generally, the function and value of tolerance depend on the equality of the prevalent society in which tolerance is practiced. So, tolerance can only be practiced when there is equality in the society. Tolerance is an end in itself. It's only an end in itself, only when it is truly universal, practiced by the rulers as well as the ruled, by the lords as well as the peasants, by the sheriffs as well as their victims. With this, I think most of us would agree. But Mark Hoos will say only leftist expression is worthy of tolerance. And how does he get there? Under current conditions, then current conditions of 1965, tolerance, Mark Hoos claims, is granted only when expression supports the repressive status quo. That is, currently, the only tolerance is granted to that expression which supports the repressive status quo. That is the only tolerance there is. That's the degree of tolerance that is accepted. Quote, within the framework of such a social structure as that, tolerance can be safely practiced and proclaimed. These are the two types of tolerance which exist at that time. Passive toleration of entrenched and established attitudes and ideas, even if their damaging effect on man and nature is evident. So, toleration of established ideas, even when they're damaging and their damaging nature is evident. And two, the act of official tolerance granted to the right as well as to the left, this kind of pro forma extension of tolerance to movements of aggression as well as to movements of peace, and this can't be allowed, to the party of hate as well as to the party of humanity. So, tolerance to the right as well as to the left, to movements of aggression as well as to movements of peace, to the party of hate as well as to the party of humanity. I call this non-partisan tolerance abstract or pure, inasmuch as it refrains from taking sides. But in doing so, it actually takes sides, he says, because it protects the already established machinery of discrimination. Here we're getting to the point of where and how they draw the line. In other words, the expression of the right supports aggression, hate, and discrimination, while that of the left supports peace and humanity. That would take many of us by surprise today. Thus, he sees pure or abstract tolerance as ridiculous, just purely ridiculous, quote unquote. You can't have pure tolerance because it's the toleration of intolerance. It would follow, then, that Mark Hoos thinks only leftist speech should be tolerated, and that is exactly what he argues. Why? How, you ask? Because, citing John Stuart Mill, he argues that tolerance was only a means to promote freedom and truth. Mark Hoos argues that tolerance is not a matter of compromise between freedom and law. Rather, tolerance should be extended for, quote, creating the society in which man is no longer enslaved by institutions which vitiate or weaken self-determination from the beginning. So tolerance should be extended for creating the society in which man is no longer enslaved by institutions, etc. So he's now, you know, he's basically making the rules for what should be tolerated. And as we shall see, for Marcuse, it is the left that is the agent for bringing about freedom and truth. How could Marcuse make this claim after the horrific repression in the Soviet Union had come to light? This reasoning has to be an exemption granted to the left for the political crimes of leftism in power, but that's an aside. Let's see why only the left deserve tolerance. Tolerance cannot be indiscriminate and equal with respect to the contents of expression. Let me say that again. Tolerance cannot be indiscriminate and equal with respect to the contents of expression, neither in word nor in deed. It cannot protect false words and wrong deeds, which demonstrate that they contradict and counteract the possibilities of liberation. So, somebody here has to be the arbiter of what's wrong and what's not, what's false and what's true. And guess who that'll be? Tolerance of free speech is the way of improvement only, see? Only speech that is about improvement should be tolerated, of progress and liberation defined in their terms. Not because there is no objective truth, and improvement must necessarily be a compromise, but because there is an objective truth which can be discovered, ascertained, only in learning and comprehending that which is and that which ought to be done for the sake of improving the lot of mankind. So, in short, what he's saying here is that tolerance should only be about allowing speech that is about improvement and improving the lot of mankind. And so, again, we have somebody being set up here as the arbiter. And, of course, censorship is on the way. And what kind of politics do you imagine Marcuse seeks as improving the lot of mankind? I shall discuss this question only with reference to the political movements, attitudes, schools of thought, philosophies, which are political in the widest sense, and under the recurrent conditions of oppression, exploitation, etc., etc., where only that which either supports oppression, etc., etc., is allowed expression, wherein as much as it does not threaten existing conditions, or is properly contained by them, impartial tolerance is repressive in itself. It is a false tolerance, he says. And tolerance was always meant to be liberating. And under these conditions, then, and because the expression of the right supports the repressive status quo, tolerance should only be granted to liberating expressions and deeds. And liberating tolerance, then, would mean intolerance against movements from the right and toleration of movements from the left. There it is. In yellow and orange. Liberating tolerance, then, would mean intolerance against movements from the right and toleration of movements from the left. As to the scope of this tolerance and intolerance, it would extend to the stage of action as well as discussion and propaganda of deed as well as word. Not only would it not allow words or speech, it would also prohibit deeds, and it would require the withdrawal of tolerance from regressive, quote-unquote, movements before they can become active. So they have to be stopped even before they start. Intolerance toward thought, opinion, and word. Intolerance even toward thought, opinion, and word. And finally, intolerance in the opposite direction. That is, toward the self-styled conservatives, to the political right. These anti-democratic notions respond to the actual development of the democratic society, which has destroyed the basis for universal tolerance. Okay, so he's saying that there has to be intolerance even towards thought. How is that going to be precluded? That is a question. Real tolerance, then, must begin with stopping the words and images which feed this consciousness. Consciousness that supports the status quo. And what's in yellow, of course, quoted. In other words, to have toleration of liberation rather than a repressive tolerance, repression is necessary. In order to have toleration of liberation or liberational ideas, then there must be a repressive tolerance, or repression is necessary. In order to avoid so-called repressive tolerance, we have to repress, is what he's saying. Marcuse then openly admits, to be sure, this is censorship. Even pre-censorship, We're precluding thoughts even, but openly directed against the more or less hidden censorship that permeates the free media. So, he justifies censorship or pre-censorship, whatever that is, by virtue of the fact that the system itself is a form of censorship, and so therefore, he's likewise, I suppose, repressing censorship too in the process. If that accounts for the left's belief that it has the right to shut down expression and action from regressive, quote-unquote, movements and the right, the following accounts for their justification to use violence to do so. But I believe, quote, that there is a natural right of resistance for oppressed and overpowered minorities to use extra-legal means if the legal ones have proved to be inadequate. Extra-legal, what is that? And moreover, their violence is not violence because, quote, if they use violence, they do not start a new chain of violence, but try to break and establish one. So the violence of those who are oppressed or repressed is not violence. And there we have it, folks. Because the world is a terrible place and only leftists want to make it better, leftist politics is the only allowable politics, and the left is justified in their use of violence to shut down other politics. Now, some critical conclusions on Marcuse. Marcuse was the most practically influential member of the Frankfurt School. He helped to translate Marxism into the identity politics of the new left, which, as we saw, was this cobbling together of identity politics groups and interest groups into a new coalition in replacement of the working class as the agent of change. Although the new left gave up on the working class as the agent of change and saw it as irredeemably conservative, quote-unquote, and that's quoting Marcuse, revolution nonetheless remained the objective. Marcuse was central to articulating the revolutionary politics of the new left. Marcuse argued that a revolution in consciousness was necessary for a cultural, economic, and political revolution. So once again, it's the subject that must be changed. The imperative for a revolution in consciousness and the adoption of Soviet and Maoist rituals of struggle sessions and self-criticism goes a long way to explain the contemporary left's focus on individuals, on cancel culture.